Ladies and gentlemen, this is the About Last Night show. I'm your host, Brad Williams. Joining me is my co-host, Adam Ray.
Hey.
And we have a very special guest.
Yeah, it's a very special day.
Very special.
And
I must say so myself.
And even if you don't recognize the name, this man...
What do you mean you don't recognize
yeah, Brad, what
name.
A fuck, what a well, shitty
I'm
intro.
I'm just saying
Let's
that you're a monument. Okay.
Jesus.
Ladies and gentlemen, this Wait, is the About Last
Brad.
Night show.
I bought,
What's this?
I bought my intro.
You brought
your...
You know, that's funny. I mean, yeah. I mean, I guess, has there ever been a time when comics would... Because, you know, you have to tell the host your intro when you go up. Do people ever... Have you seen people give their intros to the host before they go up to really... Like, if it's
oh,
a lot
sure.
of credits?
Yeah, yeah.
This day and age, I feel like people, it's just like a couple things. Or some comics, it's like, I don't care what you say, but...
Yeah, no, some guys are particular and some guys aren't. And, you know, it's always funny... If you need an introduction,
sure.
You know, how good are you?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Good philosophy.
Well, how famous you are, not
yeah.
how good you are.
Yeah, yeah.
We are talking to the legendary Bud Friedman.
Yeah, you have credits worthy of an introduction.
And basically, if you've ever been to a comedy club, you owe this man a debt of gratitude. Not just the Improvs, which he started, you founded in 1963. Founded
Very good,
the original improvisation.
44th Street.
In
right?
New York.
44th Street.
In the corner of 9th and...
9th.
Well, there you go.
Hell's Kitchen.
Adam Ray does
a little
history.
Bit of research, yeah.
There you go. And why all people owe you such a debt of gratitude is because people don't realize there was a time when there wasn't comedy clubs. We all take it for granted nowadays.
Well, that Jay Leno used to say, before me, there was no comedy.
You know, wow. So, there really wasn't.
Yeah.
Well, it was.
I mean, you heard stories about guys like Lenny Bruce and Richard Pryor having to go up and just open in front of strippers or bands and maybe the Catskills. Like, those were the only places where stand-up really was. You brought a home.
Coincidentally, that's how Brad and I met, doing stand-up at a strip club.
Oh, I thought the Catskills.
Yeah,
this
guy, yeah.
Pretty good.
Yeah, that too.
I saw Richard Pryor in the Catskills. I wouldn't say he was a regular there, but
yeah.
In the Catskills.
When did you see him?
Well, I saw Richard for the first time in 1964.
Wow.
I just opened.
What did you think when you saw him?
Oh, he's brilliant. You know, from day one, he was on the top of my list. Absolutely.
I'm always curious because you told me on the shuttle back when we were at the Montreal
Comedy Festival.
In your private car, yeah. That's right. Yeah. So Bud and I meet on the way out from the Montreal Comedy Festival, and you're very gracious.
Contracts stashed under our arms like you could not believe,
yeah.
Brad.
Yeah.
I don't want to make you jealous or anything.
Yeah.
We got offers up the kazoo.
Holding deals from NBC, CBS, all that
jazz.
Yeah,
hold this, I think.
And I think, and so we start chatting, and then you were like, what, do you want to go with us in our private car to the airport? And I was like, yeah. I would love to. And then the girl goes, oh, I'm sorry, actually, Mr. Friedman, it's actually just a shuttle that everybody takes. And you're like, oh, cool, what's your name? She's like, Catherine. Catherine, great. I got to remind myself to give that name to the festival so they don't have you work here again. And she was like, oh, no, you're not kidding. Yeah.
Sharp as ever,
but you were telling me on that shuttle back that guys like Chappelle and Pryor that you saw right off the bat that you just knew there was like something in them. But then you were saying that guys like Sandler, you and Alex, your wife, both were like, yeah, I mean, you knew he was funny.
No, Alex.
She thought with
one.
Adam.
Yeah. We saw Adam, you know, before he got Saturday Night Live. He was completely unknown. We were in New York for a couple of days, and Alex is a good sport, and she goes. We go to comedy clubs all over the world.
Sure.
That way, I can write off our vacations. But, but we were at I think Catch, and Adam went on, and when he finished, Alex, my wife, who's not in the business, says or wasn't when she met me, says, "You should go talk to that young man." I said, "Why? He doesn't have an act." And she says, "He's got something. Go talk to him."
Wow.
And I did. And 3 weeks later, he moved out to L.A.
Wow. So,
I can't remember. I think I've seen some old tape of him, but he had that. He kind of had some of that little of that still, but it was a lot younger and a lot more. Like, he's just really kind of awkward bar mitzvah boy, but like, you're right. I mean, there was something.
Now, when you're in New York in the early 60s, what makes you have the idea of was the improvisation even really a comedy club when it started off, or was it sort
Brad,
of a mix of
you're looking
magicians?
At a comedy
or?
Genius.
humble one at that, too.
Oh, yes. I started the club in 1963, in February, as a coffee house with food. We didn't have a liquor license or anything.
Okay.
For kids in Broadway shows to come in and sing after they finished their shows.
Okay, so like a late night place.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely late night. And one night, after about a year, coincidentally, we just got a wine and beer license, this comic came in by the name of Dave Astor. And Dave was a comics comic. No one you would probably know. He's long gone. But he was playing the Blue Angel, which is another place you wouldn't know of. But it was the place to work in the east side of New York. And,
sure.
And
was it similar to a Chuck E. Cheese? I'm just trying to find some sort of connection here.
No, let me. It's hard to describe because they don't have places.
They don't have them anymore. Okay.
It was a word you probably wouldn't be familiar with. Sophisticated.
Right. Oh, sophisticated. Let me Google that.
I think that's a band from Orange County.
Yeah. It's a Duke Ellington song. Yeah. And anyway, he got up and performed, and he enjoyed it. He came back the next night, and a couple of his friends. You know, his peers came to see him at the Blue Angel. He brought him to the Improv. Yeah. And they got up and performed, and that's how I became a comedy genius for the first time.
So, and what did you see in them performing that made you think,
I found out I had a better ear for comedy than I did for singing, and I'd rather hear a joke being told over and over with nuances, you know, rather than the same fucking song over and over and over. You know, everyone will sing as long... Oliver was on Broadway. That was a show.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And everyone sang, "As Long As He Needs Me." You know.
Sure.
And, you know, in those days, in the early 60s, a lot
wasn't
of
too much variation.
Weren't
right?
out.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, guys getting up singing As Long As He Needs Me. I didn't know what the hell they were talking
about.
Yeah.
Right.
I digress. Right. Anyway. Right. But,
wait, so there had to have been a handful of comics because obviously, like, everyone attributes, like, the. You know, a lot of you being instrumental in careers for, you know, Jay Leno and Robert Klein and Rodney Dangerfield and Richard Pryor and Andy Kaufman and Freddie Prinze. Like, were those the guys that maybe you saw that you to be your almost like your first group?
Well, the first group was Dave Astor, Richard Pryor, and a guy named Ron Carey. Ron was one of the funniest guys on, you know, I put him there up there with the top three with Pryor.
Wow.
He played the, you should buy an expression, the short cop in Bonnie Miller, who wanted to become...
I'm so offended right now.
wanted to become a detective.
Okay.
He was in uniform. And he was also in a lot of Mel Brooks movies. And
by the way, Dwarf Detective would be a great movie, Brett. if we can somehow get that going.
Hey, we had Paul Feig on here earlier. We can call him up.
Sure.
He did the heat, Dwarf Detective.
He's got some heat on him. Yeah.
A sure. little. Yeah, but you have to wear a dress.
Sign me up, bud.
Have to.
Dwarf Detective in drag.
Get to,
It's got an alliteration.
Yeah. Sure, it'll work.
Ron Carey was the guy in the movie High Anxiety. He grabbed the suitcases from Mel Brooks, and he says, I don't got it. But he used to do, in 1963 and 4, he did Friday, Saturday night, four shows. Wow. And we didn't have shows in those days.
Right.
But he sold everything out. He was so fucking funny. Doing Catholic material. He was very Catholic, brought up. And he did all this Catholic material, which was in those days so avant-garde. And I just heard a record of his recently. Played it. And it wasn't that now. It's
sure,
nothing.
It doesn't hold up.
Then,
sure, sure.
Wow.
Crushed.
It was, you know, so cutting edge. It was so terrific. But funny.
Right.
Still funny. Yeah. He was a hysterical person.
And those are the types of guys that you were really attracted to.
Yeah, but what they did was... we had one little microphone, and Dave Astor would sit in the corner, tell a story, and Richard Pryor and Ron Carey would act them out.
Wow.
Oh, man.
Wow. Like Story Theater, long before Story Theater came along. And then Robert Klein came along. Rodney Dangerfield came in. A gal named Liz Torres, who was a singing comedian.
When a guy like Rodney comes in, because he came in... He had started stand-up earlier in life and then sort of took a break.
Was his third comeback.
Yeah, he sold, like, air conditioners for a while or something.
No, aluminum siding. Let's
aluminum
get
siding.
Clear
yes. You know. All right, I'm trying.
Oh, no, I mean, because he was very proud.
Boy, so far your Dwarf Detective work has just been awful. It's just been terrible. The first
terrible
case has
bitch.
Not been cracked, yeah.
But so this is his third try, and is he still going on as, what is it?
Rodney.
Oh, so,
no,
so,
he came
so he's
in
going
his,
on at Rodney.
No, that's the story. He opened at the Living Room, which was not quite a bonsoir, but very nice little East Side place where they paid you.
Right. Oh, wow.
And he got a review in the New York Times, Rodney Dangerfield. And I expected some Princetonian guy to come in with a, you know, sick sucker suit on.
Right. Sure,
you
sure.
Know, a little tie.
Right.
And this middle-aged, drunk, fat guy comes in, and it's Rodney. And he's drunk, and he goes up and he bombs. He comes back the next night sober, and he says, I'll show these punks. And he wiped up the floor.
Wow.
And he became our literally our house MC for about 2.5 years.
Wow.
And if you were a celebrity and came in the audience, you better be prepared to get up because Rodney would get you up.
No
on
kidding.
The stage, yeah.
Wow. So, and that's the thing is you were the place that all the, like you said, you started as a place for the Broadway performers
right.
to go. But I'm sure the place built its reputation on just like people just show up.
Well, so once celebrities start coming to comedy.
Oh, but we also had, you know, besides the comedians would show mm-hmm. up, you know, I remember Bill Cosby coming in the audience and Rodney making him get up. He didn't want to get up, but he got up. But we had Judy Garland and Liza Minnelli singing together with Peter Allen playing the piano.
What? Wow.
We had one night, we had, now you may not know all these people, I'm not being.
I saw Justin Bieber at the Laugh Factory 2 weeks ago. That's the story I have. That's, I mean, Jesus, that's way
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's Judy not Garland?
Judy Garland and Liza singing at the same time.
I sang with Judy.
What?
You sang with Judy Garland?
Her piano player.
All our gay fans just got erections right now. They're like, what?
Her last piano player was a former piano player of mine, and he used to bring her in, mm-hmm. just before she died. And one night, there was a few people were there, and a friend of mine, Jack Knight, who is an actor and a singer and a bon vivant and a carpenter, he helped build both clubs, and he did a series of Dom DeLuise out here when I came out to help me find the Improv. But anyway. So Jack is this big stock. He's 6'1", 190 pounds. And we had this terrazzo floor in front of the little stage. And Judy's on the stage singing. John Myers is playing the piano. Mm-hmm. And she's singing on the boardwalk in Atlantic City. And I'm on a chair. And Jack is pushing me like it's the thing on the boardwalk in Atlantic City.
Oh, right. Things. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we're all singing together. And then other songs we sang together. And then there's two couples in the room. Maybe 10 people altogether. There's two couples, and they were gypsies, real gypsies, not like the ones on Broadway.
Right.
And a woman calls me and says, I want to sing next. And
okay.
I said, well, I'm sorry, but Miss Garland is singing. And
yeah.
I'm not going to replace her with you.
She
says, well,
she knows
she's
the
been up
man,
there.
So
I don't care who she is. I want to sing. I said, get the fuck out of here. Pay your check.
First.
I couldn't believe. She didn't know who Judy Garland was, I don't think. Yeah.
Wow.
And, you know. So she picked my wallet and left. Judy is...
That may be the first gypsy joke in the history of the About Last Night podcast.
Yeah, that's great. And it was a good one. Yeah.
I hope it won't be the last.
Yeah.
I hope not either.
How was it? Wait, was that... That was post-Wizard of Oz, yeah? That she was...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
She was a child.
Yeah.
This is a year before she died. Jeez. Then we had a night with Christopher Plummer and Dudley Moore playing the piano. Albert Finney, Academy Award winner, playing bongos on a chair.
Jesus.
British actor. Tuesday Wells... Tuesday Wells,
Tuesday
ring
Wells?
A bell.
No.
Look her up.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The gorgeous, gorgeous young lady who was going out with Dudley Moore. Dudley Moore?
Yeah, of course. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Obviously.
And she was stretched out on the piano. And by the way, the piano was a 66-key keyboard, upright.
Wow.
So it was a short thing. And she was stretched out looking gorgeous.
Yeah, of course.
And Jason Robards was singing.
Yep. Wow.
And in the corner was a guy with a guitar. Now, we're snobs. We're Broadway snobs.
Sure.
In the corner is this guy playing the guitar, and he wants to join in. And we didn't have a liquor license, nothing, wine, nothing. He sent his friend home 3 different times to get bottles of champagne for us, good champagne to drink. And finally we let him sing along.
Yeah.
And because he was a rock and roll composer, that's all we knew.
Right.
Well, his name was Mort Schumann. Mort Schumann wrote, I don't know, 10 Presley hits.
Did he really?
Oh, wow.
And he also wrote... Jacques Brel is alive and well. I don't know.
Jesus.
You know,
yeah, 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 yeah.
And
all I did was musicals in high school and college. Yeah.
Okay. So it was, you know, some
That's
night.
That's incredible.
And there were nights we were there till sun up, singing, doing comedy,
and I keep hearing those. You know, now at the Hollywood Improv, where it's all our homes here in L.A. And like Eddie, the bartender.
Oh, yeah.
He'll tell me stories every now and then of just how. It was, and it's just like, I guess it's somewhat comparable now, but I mean, it doesn't sound like it's even close.
Okay. I mean, even here, out here, can you imagine walking into your bar when I still ran the club?
Sure.
And there's Jessica Lange and what's her boyfriend's name?
Warren Beatty?
No. The Sam Shepard.
Yeah.
Drinking in the corner of the bar. Jesus. Nobody's bothering him.
Just hanging out.
Just drinking in the corner of the bar.
Yeah, I mean, and it's kind of like what you said. Now our stories are, well, we did stand up at the Laugh Factory, and Bieber was there,
yeah.
So.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's like, but you've literally seen every comic. Is there something?
Well, who knows? Maybe people remember Justin Bieber in 2 years.
Yeah, sure.
Never can tell.
Sure, yeah, who knows? Yeah.
Is there something that you look for in a comic? Is there something that stands out to you? Like when you're judging talent, is there something that you've seen that all the greats have had? Some sort of common thread at all?
I guess the common thread would be originality.
Mm-hmm.
You like to see a new voice breaking through.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of my major judgments is the audience reaction.
Sure.
How they respond to the
If they like what's happening.
Yeah, because, although, you know, one of my discoveries and one of my favorites all time was Andy Kaufman.
Yeah.
And the audience hated him.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah,
one of
my favorites you must have too. Loved that. So you would watch him just bomb.
Oh, and I understand. And when he used to wrestle women on stage.
He really did that
like
on a Wednesday night.
Any night. And he would... And I'd have to watch the body language of men in the audience because I could became an expert because I could tell when they want to get up and hit them.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
wow.
And they would, right?
Pat them on the show. No, I'd stop them. Okay. Hey, it's only it's a routine. It's a joke.
It's an act.
It's his girlfriend.
Right? I heard a story. I heard a rumor, and I want to know if this is true from you, that when you first met Andy, he talked to you not as Andy Kaufman,
absolutely.
But he was doing his Latka voice from Taxi.
He pulled the shit out of me.
So, absolutely. I mean, and that's so mind-boggling to me because every time I meet a club owner or someone who could definitely further my career, get me gigs, I'm on my best behavior. It's yes sir, no sir, and all that. And then and then you meet Andy, and he's like, "Hello, Mr. Friedman.
Exactly.
I'm here to do for you the show." And then just the balls to do that.
Yeah.
That's exactly what he did.
Would he get booked at? I mean. Could he do, after a while, people would catch on to what he was doing as an actor?
No, it took him, you know, he'd always have a new twist.
Right.
You know, when I opened out here, the Comedy Store had...
Yeah, when did you move out from New York and decide to take
opened here, I moved out, I opened in 75 here.
Oh,
the Comedy Store had been open 2 years. We had already been open for a dozen years in New York. But Mitzi still thinks I stole her idea, but that's another story.
Mitzi Shore
that's
owned
that's our
Comedy Store.
And all my guys... We're out here, Jimmy Walker, Freddie Prinze, Jimmy, Freddie, Richard Pryor, and somebody else.
Richard Lewis?
Oh, Jay Leno. Jay Leno, right.
Yeah, because you used to manage Leno,
right? Yeah, I used to manage Leno. So they were all out here. So
And I appreciate everything you did for me, by the way. I appreciate everything, yeah.
And they would all come. Yeah, I knew they'd all come to the club.
Yeah,
right.
But... I wanted somebody new that they hadn't seen out here.
Mm-hmm.
So I brought out Andy for a month. And
what were the crowd? What were the crowd reactions with him?
Oh, they were great. You know, the crowd built up over the time, the month because
it's an acquired taste, right?
And then he moved out here as a result. And then I brought out Elaine Boozler.
Yeah.
The next month.
Yeah.
And by then we were on our way. So.
Did you think Jim Carrey did a great job portraying Andy?
He was wonderful.
I thought that was one of my favorite movies.
It made me cry.
Yeah.
You know, I was in it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I remember.
Playing myself.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, sure. Stretch the acting muscles a little bit.
Right.
Now,
exactly.
What was that? I mean, what was that like? Because obviously you were instrumental in Andy's career and became friends with him, I'm sure. So, like, then to be in that movie and, I mean, was it pretty surreal to have it?
Oh, it was, you know.
And see Jim take it on and make
and
it
he would be
so
in
believable.
Full character all the time. And when I came in for makeup one day, I said, "Have you seen Jim Carrey yet?" And the makeup girl says, "Lady says, no, but I saw Andy Kaufman."
Wow!
No, and he made me cry once. We did a scene together, and he just
because he was just so
just
spot
so
on.
Right?
It's,
it's
like you were looking right back at him.
How did you? Jim came into the club a lot. Yeah, did you get to see him early on?
We got Jim started when we did Evening at the Improv.
Mm-hmm.
We were a Canadian content show, which meant that we had to use X amount of Canadians on the show in order to get this tax status. It was something my television associate came up with brilliant. And so we had to use everybody named Lorne.
Mm. Yeah, right.
Right.
As hosts, we had a Canadian producer, Canadian director, and there weren't too many. There was only one Yuck Yucks up there at the time. We didn't know how lucky we were. And that's because I don't like the guy who owns it.
That's fine. Yeah, no.
Minor feud.
Little prick that he is.
Yes. Like the first
time.
In case
I didn't mention his name is Breslin.
Yeah, perfect.
Breslin.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah. I don't think we've done Yuck Yucks, right?
So we brought in Jim Carrey, Howie Mandel, Mike McDonald, and about 15 other guys whom we taped and then threw away the tape.
Yeah.
Wow. But we used Howie and Jim and Mike and maybe one or two others, you know, for one or two spots. But there weren't that many good Canadian comics at the time.
Now, even though you say you didn't use the tape, you just did it for the tax break, did you still see those guys and see something in them? That
no.
No?
You said no? No.
Even right? Jim early on, or there was no...
No, Jim we used. I'm saying Jim used Jim. Over and Howie, but Jim was doing impressions.
Right.
Doing nothing but impressions.
Were there? He was one of a few impression comics, or were a lot of people doing it when he was doing it?
Well, I think I would have to guess there's more impressions then than now. Think of it.
Sure. But, yeah, you had your guys like your Rich Littles, who's been doing it forever, and it's sort of.
Did you know David Fry?
I never knew David Fry. No.
I mean, you know the name.
Oh yeah. I know the name. Yes.
You wouldn't know him. Yeah. No, I mean. But
I would like to think that Jim Carrey is another one of those guys that you see and you're just immediately like, all right, well, the way he's, contorting his body and turning himself, transforming himself into. That's always the one thing that impressed me about him when I would see him on A Living Color and why I feel like he's influenced me more than most Saturday Night Live people is that, like, he not only is he literally becomes you just don't see him be like, oh, yeah, he's doing an impression of whatever. It's like he does something in his body to or his face to really just.
What he did with Andy was
unreal.
Now when you were managing Jay Leno, Jay, when you hear stories about him, it's always just utter workaholic, just total dedication to the craft. Could you see that from a young age in him? Like, yeah, this guy's destined for greatness.
I smile when you say that because the story how the second coming of my genius.
Okay.
Was one night
the name of this podcast,
on 44th Street and 9th Avenue. Mm-hmm. Now, you've been to New York, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes up to me one night and he says, Mr. Freeman, he says, I've been driving down three nights in a row from Boston.
Everybody's got a J.
Yeah.
And not getting on.
Oh, jeez.
Well, how do I get on? I said, well, you've been driving down from Boston, not getting on, then driving home again that night? Yeah, three nights in a row.
That's ridiculous.
You're on next.
Whoa.
Because, I mean, you're looking at a guy, and this is true. The first time Alex and I, my wife and I, went to Palm Springs 33 years ago, we spent the night in Riverside to break up the trip.
Sure.
That's how much I like to drive. Do you realize how funny that is?
Yeah, because Riverside's not close.
It's quite out of the way.
Well, Riverside is, no.
It's like an hour away or something,
right? Yeah, an hour away, and another hour would be Palm Springs.
Oh, okay, you'd be there
in
no time.
So a two-hour trip, I had to break it up.
Wow, okay.
That's how I like to drive. Okay. I won't be here all week. Anyway, so Jay went on, and he's brilliant.
And then he just said, "Wow!" But what? I mean, that's so great that you were able to do that, and that you saw that, and that you just saw the dedication that a young guy would have. Because so many times now, you see club owners, and it's just, how many people did you bring? What do you got? What have I seen you on? It seems like. Back when you were doing this, you really saw the need to nurture comics and say, "Yeah, let's let you develop your act."
Yeah.
Well, everybody needs a boost, right? I mean, Jay, if he hadn't, I mean, who knows if you hadn't have done that? Because then I'm sure
Jay would have been a comic.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, I used to take credit for everyone's career, and then I realized they would have made it without me, not as fast.
Sure.
But they would have been, except maybe for Jimmy Walker. But that's another story. I'm grateful past it. But anyway,
I did a pilot with that guy.
You did?
Yeah.
Recently?
About 3 years ago with him, Natasha Leggero, and Eddie Pepitone about 3-4 years ago.
Oh.
Never saw the light of day. But
really?
He came in for one day, didn't know many of his lines, ended up improvising most of them, so that was tough
to
follow.
And he's a great improviser.
Yeah.
I wish you guys at home could see the dramatic eye roll that I just pulled.
I just knocked my microphone out of my...
Wait, but with Jay, I mean, and then, you know, to take over for Carson, I mean, like... Again, is that something you, from the get-go, when you saw him and you gave him that chance, you're like, oh, good, I'm glad I was able to get him
Adam,
going.
I never thought that stand-up comics would become as important as they are today. You know, I cannot Not my wildest dreams.
Yeah, because you see, I mean, you see, there's a lot of people who get their news today from stand-up comics,
right,
whether it be Bill Maher, Jon Stewart,
or even
watching The Tonight Show and getting Jay's say on the day.
Exactly.
I used to watch, when I would watch Geraldo and listen to him just pull up things from the news, I was like, that's how I'd get informed. Greg Geraldo.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Who am I thinking?
Geraldo Rivera.
Geraldo Rivera, right.
Well, also a great comic.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
He's just not trying to be.
Yeah. And did you also manage Bette Midler?
I managed Bette Midler, yes.
So so anyone who's a fan of the Showgirl owes that to you.
Right.
Wow.
So, and then you would put on Bette, like, in the original days of the Improv, right?
Oh, yeah. Well,
to do stand-up?
Well, she came in to sing.
Mm-hmm.
But hanging around the Improv, she figured she better do some funny lines in between. So she started to do funny lines in between.
And developed some timing.
Yeah,
audience.
Yeah.
My mom just saw her one-woman show in New York
about
3 months ago.
Yeah. Alex and I flew in for the opening.
Did you really?
And her manager says, we have to put you in the mezzanine because she doesn't want to see anybody she knows in the fucking... I said, we flew in from L.A. to see her.
You can put us... And like Bette Midler, the consummate professional that she is, would ever be in the middle of an act, be scanning the audience, see your face and go, oh, bud.
Yeah,
But now here's my question. Would you rather see people she knows, or like what if Brad was just like standing on a seat mid-thing? If you see a dwarf midway through your show, what throws you off more, people you know or that?
Well, I don't know. We'll have to ask him when we see
him. Yeah, okay. So you were using the club.
So Bette came in the first time. She was in Fiddler. She had a small role. Mm-hmm. And a woman who was in the show, a character lady that I knew, brought her in. And Bette sang what we now laughingly refer to as two dirges. You know, in the Port of Amsterdam, as a matter of fact.
Right.
In the Port of Amsterdam.
Right.
And I said, thanks very much, and no thank you.
Yeah.
And then 6 months later, I went to see an ex-waitress of mine who coincidentally was understudying Bette in Fiddler.
Oh, wow.
Perform at a place called the African Room.
All right.
East of Broadway on 45th Street, I think it was, or 43rd. And I went to see this gal, Roz, sing, and... Bette came on first and sang Am I Blue and just blew me away. And I said, you got to come back.
Wow. And you said, what asshole fired you from the Improv? Oh, yeah, that guy.
Now, when you would tell people like Bette and Rodney and Jay to keep coming back, I mean, there must have been something also about you and the room that they loved because...
Oh, the room was magic.
Because there's places I've been to that maybe, some, shithole, and they're like, please come back anytime. But you can tell it's because they're like, we need more people that are working to get this place going. But they must have... What was it about your room that was...
It was just the hippest room in the world.
Yeah.
Rodney said, if you do well here, it means you ain't got no act. And I had no idea what that meant until a few years later I was managing a comedian. They weren't all Bette and Jays by the name of Marvin Braverman. And Marvin was seen at the club by Anne Margaret and her husband and got a gig opening for Anne
her
at
husband,
the Hilton
Mel
International.
Brooks.
Anne
Bancroft and Margaret. Wow. All right.
Boy, you're about 2 million miles away. Anyway.
That's both Adam Ray and I, USC Education, there in the works.
And he goes to Vegas, and here's a man who never cursed on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And the first two shows I stayed for in Vegas, he did okay, but he sweated a lot.
Right.
Alan Carr was a very, very effeminate man who managed Ann Margaret. And he and I made a deal because Marvin owed everybody money, including me, that out of the $1,500, which was a considerable amount of money.
Absolutely.
Give Marvin $300 cash, send the rest to me, and when Marvin gets back, we'll settle up. And Marvin, I said, you'll have a little nest egg when you come back, and you'll have paid off everybody. Marvin says, great. So I leave. I get a call 2 days later from Alan. He's in tears. Oh, bud, but I can't stand it. I said, but he's calling me 3 in the morning. He's playing... what's that thing that James
Uno.
Bond plays?
Baccarat.
He's playing
Go
Baccarat.
Oh.
and he wants money all the time. And I said, he's playing Baccarat? I don't fucking play Baccarat. Alan says, I can't take it anymore. I said, give him the money and forget about it.
Oh, shit.
But the point was, I'm sorry, I digress.
I don't know. These are all great stories.
Yeah. He split his pants on stage in a tuxedo. He started cursing the next dinner show when the Hilton buyer was in the, buyer was there with his family.
Perfect time to start cursing.
Because he couldn't handle the crowds.
Right.
This was Vegas then, a lot different from now. It was not as homogenized. It was not, shall you dare use the word sophisticated again?
Yes.
You know, so he couldn't handle it. Wow. And that's what Rodney meant, because this room was so hip, mm-hmm. 44th and 9th. That, you know, it was all showbiz people, practically.
So he started cursing as a defense mechanism, or to kind of fit in?
He
didn't know what
days.
To do. Okay,
no,
yeah. Wow.
He just got
flustered. I guess that's what, you know, and that, I think that's actually partially why what happened to Michael Richards, don't you think? Like, what, that whole thing? I mean, he just...
That's such bullshit. Are they not saying motherfucker there anymore?
No, I think... Did they take that word out of there?
Yeah, that was the whole thing with Richard. And Jamie said, no more motherfuckers here. No, we're not going to say that anymore.
Really?
I'm pretty sure I said it two nights ago.
I'm pretty sure you've heard a few,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
They're full of shit, too. You know,
so. I'm always,
did you know Michael?
Huh?
Do you know Michael? Yeah.
Very well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he seems like I've seen him on the Jerry Seinfeld's web series, and it seems like when he's in having conversations, he seems like a nice guy.
He's a wonderful guy.
And a lot of people jumped on him for that. And what people don't realize is before this advent of Twitter and YouTube and instant information, that kind
of
stuff would happen all the time at comedy clubs. You'd bomb, you maybe freak out, you have a bad moment that you don't want everyone to see.
Right, yeah.
But then the next day, you went up and tried it again, and
I'm sure we don't have to talk to you about that. But
oh, sure, the world famous lap dance. I've kicked a couple broads in the head. I'm not gonna lie. You do that cartwheel.
That's true. You know, it was just he took a big hit for no really good reason. He thought he was being funny.
Yeah,
and. I have so much respect for anyone that runs a comedy club, just because they have to deal with comedians, and we're not exactly always the most agreeable people on the planet. You know, we're doing a job that's by ourselves. So when we have a boss, then there's definitely some pushback sometimes. I mean, how do you deal with a comic that's just freaking out?
Yeah, like a manager almost, so managing all these egos and personalities.
Yeah, well, you know, listen, it's. What I do now, what I say now, is I'm not going to book. The only thing I'm booking now is Vegas and Tahoe and
which. Thank you, by the way.
Springs. You're welcome.
Yeah, that's one of those seeing people. He saw me in the crowd of the Improv one night, and he told Dave, he goes, "Hey, you can book him in Tahoe." And you know, granted, I said that sometimes you just base off the audience reaction and not what's being said. And that night, I didn't do any material. I just shimmied for 15 minutes, and Bud was like, "That guy's got some great moves. Book him in Tahoe."
That just shows you tits can get you work, Adam Ray. Right.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
But I mean, you've had to have moments with the club when comics would just get upset with you, threaten you, anything like that?
Not understanding the business side. A lot of comics just don't have that.
Yeah, just say, you know, I say now, you know, I've been doing it 50 years. I say, it's just not worth the effort. I'm not going to, you know, bother with this person again. That's all. You know, there are plenty more out there. So I've had arguments with comics over the years that I wanted to save.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, worked it out.
Was Larry David one of them?
No, never had a problem with Larry.
Never, right? You told me some unbelievable, because he may be one of my favorite comedic minds on the planet, and Curb, my favorite show, obviously Seinfeld. But you're saying that, and this was so interesting, how similar to Andy, where he would be.
But he didn't do it intentionally.
Right. He didn't do it intentionally. But that's, to me, is almost.
Andy had a plan. Larry just went up there and went.
Yeah,
what
exactly.
But you said even like a cough would throw him off, and he'd be like, I can't do this. Like, just so neurotic, yeah?
And, you know, we'd stand in the back, and Alex and I, the comics, and we'd just laugh our asses off.
He was a comics comic. Yeah, people wanted. Yeah,
exactly.
Well, yeah, because you didn't know how long he was going to be on stage.
Yeah.
The story I hear all the time on Larry is that one time he walked on stage and to do stand up, and he looks at the audience, and before they said a word, and before he says a word, he just goes, nope.
Yeah.
And he walks off stage.
Well, you know, Alex and I were in New York, 1994, I guess. When did Seinfeld go on the air?
I think 93.
Well, it was 92? Just before Seinfeld went on the air. Well, before the pilot.
Sure.
And Larry had been out here, and Alex met him out here and all. And we're walking down Madison Avenue. You hear, Alex, Bud, Alex. And it's Larry. And he jumps out of a cab, got a big smile on his face. He says, I'm so happy to be back here in New York. You have no idea. how happy I am to be back here in New York. I couldn't stand it out there in Los Angeles. I hate Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I have to go out to do a pilot, but I'll be done with that, and I'm coming right back to New York.
Wow.
Turns out the pilot was Seinfeld.
10 years later or whatever, yeah.
Yes. Get your real estate here, Larry. You're going to have some fun.
Now, did you see him and Seinfeld start to kind of develop that friendship at the I'm sure that was happening.
No, that was after I left town, actually,
okay,
and then carried over here. But it started in New York. Ironically, I just finished reading a book by a comic named John DeBellis called Stand-Up Guys, Amazon. Mm. And it covers his John's period of being a comic there, and he went on to write for Saturday Night Live, among other things, in 74, 75, into the end of the 80s, which is exactly the period I missed that was so fertile.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so that was a comedy boom right
I
there.
I knew all of these comics, mm-hmm, but I didn't know any of these stories.
Right.
And it's a wonderful book. You should get
it.
Oh,
that's great. So it's got some of that beginning, seeing the friendship and things
yeah,
like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he tells a story about Jerry getting naked and sitting at a bar stool in the bar.
What?
Jerry Seinfeld getting naked and walking in the street.
Jerry Seinfeld, the guy that won't curse on stage.
You're not talking about Tracy Morgan. It seems like
that sounds more along his lines.
Yeah.
I mean, and in terms of dealing with comics, I mean, I know you were very prevalent in Richard Lewis's career well. And Richard's one of these guys, you know, talk about neurotic. He doesn't go on stage until they call his name. He's not in the club. He's just sitting in a car, just waiting, and they go, "Hey, the feature's closing," and he doesn't even enter the club until the guy goes, "And now,
wow,
Richard Lewis."
Is that true?
Well, not when I knew him.
Yeah.
he'd be hanging around the back trying to get on.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But the first time he went on, it was audition. We did auditions earlier in the evening, and then we do the regular show. And he went on and killed.
Yeah.
Very good. I said, "Well, stick around, kid. I'll put you on later." So he tells me later that, and then he doesn't do that well later. Because his 30 friends who were in the audience during the audition didn't stick around.
Oh.
One of those situations. Oh, God.
There's so many times when that happens in terms of they have, like, comedy contests and open mic night.
Yeah.
And you see some open micer just crushing. You're like, well, I can't say he's not funny because the audience is loving him every line. then you know, you give him a gig as a host or a guest spot, and then you see him bomb, and you go, oh, that's why.
Right.
Well, there are so many stories of the auditions and one we just talked about, we just finished taping interviews. We're doing an hour special for Epics and then going on Comedy
that's
Central
right.
after that.
50th anniversary of
50th
the
anniversary. Yeah, so that's why I have the list here.
Okay.
We have Seinfeld, Jimmy Fallon, Kenan Wayans, Larry David, Louis Black, Richard Lewis, Russell Brand, the Wayans brothers, Bill Maher, Jay Leno, Judd Apatow, Kathy Griffin. And Ray Romano. And Ray tells a story about...
Yeah, you know, about being married. You know, it's crazy. Yeah.
He came into the club with his sister to an audition night, and he puts his name in the hat, and she puts another name in the hat, a non-sexual name, you know, like Lynn Seeger or something like that. And Lynn Seeger gets picked. So he goes up as Lynn Seeger.
That's awesome.
And he says, "I became Lynn Seeger for 3 months. I was Lynn Seeger with him until I got really established and could tell I'm really Ray Romano."
Wow. What a great.
But they did a taping. They had Fallon on the stage talking. And he tells a story every time he had to follow Seinfeld on and Melrose Avenue.
Oh, jeez.
Hot it was.
Right.
And Jerry walks in.
While he's giving this recount?
Yeah, and they start going at each other, and Jerry says, "And now," Jerry says, "I'm trying to get on your show." And I says, Fallon says, "Oh, you're not." He says, "Yes, I am."
Yeah.
"Yes, I am." Yeah. And he went on about 2 weeks later.
Wow.
You know,
says, well, yeah, because Jerry Seinfeld says, "I'm trying to get on your show. You don't
sell." Right.
No.
Yeah, exactly.
I can only hope and pray that they were doing dueling Jerry Seinfelds at the time, because I know Fallon does an incredible Seinfeld impression.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Well, I would like to have you on my show. Well, I would like to come on your show.
All I'm trying to do is get on shows. Is it now? That's an incredible list, by the way.
Yeah, we also have a great interview together with Larry David and Richard Lewis.
Oh, great.
These are guys that founded everything that I've grown up loving about stand-up comedy and admiring about stand-up comedy. Guys that you, like, there's something Adam Carolla once paid this compliment to Dennis Miller, where he says, there's some guys that inspire you to do comedy. Dennis Miller made me think that I couldn't do comedy because no way could I ever be that good.
Yeah.
And that list is just full of those people. It's amazing. And they all and the crazy part about comedy is that no matter how good you are, no matter how legendary you are in the business, you all have to come from the same place, open mics, building an act, going through the same struggles. And even when you are a Jerry Seinfeld, who's the top of this business, you still got to go up at Gotham Comedy Club or whatever club, or
the well,
improv
comedian,
or whatever
the
club.
Documentary comedian. I mean, yeah. That was a, to me, that was one of the great, you saw that, I'm sure.
What's
yeah?
I'm
comedian?
Oh,
Seinfeld's
movie, yeah.
Yeah. To me, that was eye-opening because it finally gave us a chance. I was like 3 years in to see somebody at that level. It's so funny how you can just forget that they have to go through the same process and journey, and you're like, oh, he didn't just always be great. You're like, you see him going back in the clubs and not doing well was the thing that I think gave me some comfort because I was like, I was like, I thought
like
they
any
all,
other comedian, the other guys fail. Yeah.
Well, but at least it just. But I mean, well,
we're such sick fuckers.
I know. Tell me about.
But I mean,
it,
but somebody that like you didn't know that he didn't have that he had those moments is what I'm trying to say. Like
one of the sweetest experiences for me back in New York, particularly was. Seeing the guys get ready for the Tonight Show or the Ed Sullivan Show when the Tonight Show was in New York.
They would come showcase at the club
and
all the time.
Not show, they, you
or
know,
practice
just
or
break
sets.
In the material Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Mm-hmm. And you see the development, particularly with somebody like Rodney. Where
right.
Take a, you know, 10 minutes and hone it down to 5. It was just magic.
And, yeah, and
magic.
You see him trimming the fat off of jokes and
you have a favorite
rewording.
Did you have a favorite Rodney joke or a moment?
No, but my favorite joke on that story on that is Dick Cavett came in for the second time he ever performed in a club.
Host of the old
Dick Cavett show.
Yes,
yeah. And
got that one.
Way to put that together, Brad.
Very sophisticated.
I pulled it.
And Dick does a joke that he was. He went to his friend's wedding from Yale, and his friend was so rich that instead of throwing rice, they threw Uncle Ben. Then the second joke was, and that's become a classic.
Yeah.
The second joke was, and they had the caviar flown all the way in from Beluga. I didn't get it. I had to look it up.
Sure. Yeah.
And they didn't have the fucking web in that. You know,
sure. That.
And
you have to bring out the World Book Encyclopedia.
For those of you who laughed nervously, Beluga is the whale.
No, I knew that. That's why I knew that. Yeah, I knew that. Yeah.
So anyway, I knew that from the Raffi song.
I didn't know that.
Right.
At the time. And he comes back and he doesn't do that joke. He does the Uncle Ben. And I said, hey, Dick, why didn't you do that joke? You know? Mm-hmm. About the Beluga. He says, well, nobody got it. I said, geez, I loved it.
Typical club.
Pretentious
prick. Yeah. Oh, so great. But isn't that always so fascinating? No matter how many times I see comics in this business, I love seeing the process. I love seeing guys try jokes out. Okay, that didn't work. But then they go back and they try it a new time. That's why if you're in an audience and you wonder why the comic got mad at you when you were taping his or her set, you know, with your phone, putting out, like, that's why we're getting mad, because this isn't exactly...
Which will not happen at the Improv.
No, it does not. And thank you for that.
Boy, I was sitting there one night with Alex, and we're right in the middle, and I see a guy stage right all the way in the corner with his phone out. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could hardly see it, and the doorman... Right over there.
Right. He was just getting audio. Wasn't even getting video, huh?
I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's why, because these jokes aren't ready yet. We're not done. We're not, like, we're taking time. And the reason why we go up on stage and tell them is because we're trying to figure out how to make the best possible joke. So wait until we put them out on an album or a TV appearance. That's when they're ready.
Sure.
That's when they're good.
Well, it's so annoying. You know, I go to the Hollywood Bowl and... People are there with their phones videoing the performance.
Yeah.
Well, it's rude because you're looking at the guy's video camera, I mean, the phone in front of you rather than seeing the performance.
Yeah, sure. Totally.
And so they allow it.
Yeah.
And I won't go back there.
Louis got that great new bit about in his special about how he's like these parents. He's like, he went to this kid's recital and all these parents are holding up the phone. He's like, they're right in front of you. Like, what are you watching the phone? You're never going to look at that video.
You know, I'm so proud of my son. My grandson is playing in Cooperstown this week.
What?
They're doing some. It's not a. I don't know how he got there, but he's playing for
practice.
No, I mean, he's 12 years old, but he's playing for. The team is called SWAT, and he's from.
Okay.
out in West Hills.
Okay.
And it stands for Simon Wiesenthal Athletic Team.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Yeah, because when you hear the name Wiesenthal, you think athletics.
No, and you think SWAT, tough,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But my son is a geek. You know, he can do anything with a computer and the cameras and that's everything. Right. And his wife sends us an email. So you click on here, and you'll be able to – they're televising on the internet.
Sure.
Broadcasting two of the games, four of the games. We can see them on your computer.
That's great.
So, and I was going to call. He called me this morning to remind me. I turned it on. Boom, I got it on. The old shoe got it on. It's great.
Yeah.
And I said, are you videoing the games? And he says, no, I'm not. And I didn't have to ask. And I know why. Because he's there and he wants to see it.
Right.
He doesn't want to spend
be preoccupied with trying to capture.
Exactly.
Especially with a performance art that is stand-up comedy, it is so in the moment, and you have to be there. And who gives a fuck about showing the video to your friends later? It's not the same. Be there, enjoy the show. Yeah. If your friends want to see it, the friends can go to a live show. And there's nothing like stand-up comedy live, and it feels weird having to say that, but in this day and age, you kind of do. And this brings me to another question I want to ask you, Bud, and that's, is there anything you've seen change with stand-up in terms of trends, in terms of, like, how has the art form changed?
Have people gotten taller, or have the jokes?
Well, you know, that's strange you should say that, sure, because I'm going to be involved with the Cabo. I'm getting an honor, I should say, the new Cabo Film Festival.
The Cabo Comedy Festival. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they're giving me the Giant of Comedy Award.
Whoa.
And they're also, the other award, the main award, is the Jack Rollins newcomer, or something like that. Wow. Jack Rollins, do you know who he is?
I don't.
Jack Rollins is a legendary manager who managed, and his name is, he's 98, and his name is still on Woody Allen's movie as executive producer.
Really?
Rollins and Jaffe were the guys. And Jack discovered Harry Belafonte, Nicholson May, Woody Allen, Dick Cabot, Robert Klein. I go on and on and on.
Jesus.
Wow.
And so this guy is an old friend. The guy's promoting is a friend, old friend. So he's doing this. And I thought of a story back in New York. Jack used to come in the club, and Jack is the mildest, nicest man you'd ever want to meet. Powerful, but, you know, so nice.
Sure.
And the world's tallest man from Bonham and Bailey Circus was there.
Oh, great. Robert Wooden.
No,
Naldo
Eddie Carmel.
Oh, Eddie Carmel. Okay.
8 feet, 1 inch tall.
Jeez.
And the doorways at the Improv were like this in the kitchen.
Yeah.
I mean, just 2 inches bigger.
6'7".
No, I mean,
like
not
that
high.
Oh, really? Okay.
Not high. I could fill the doorway better. And Jack's about to leave just as Eddie is about to go on. And Eddie blocks the doorway. I mean, blocks the doorway. And says, Mr. Rollins, don't tell me you're leaving now. I'm going on soon. And Jack looks up and says, well, I guess I can stay a little while.
You 8-foot giant.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's so funny. So I'm getting the Giant Award the same time as Jack Rollins.
That's incredible.
I mean, Jack won't be there. But I got to tell that story.
Oh, you have to. That's a great story.
That's a great story. And the Giant of Comedy. I'll take awards I'll never get for 1,000, Alex.
Now, what about you were telling me another great story about and Chappelle being one of my favorites, because I saw him in Montreal, I told you that, the night before we were leaving, and do a whole new hour, and he's been popping in and out of town for the last couple of years, you know, piecing together an act, and it was just, I felt like I was watching, you know, just one of the best of all time, and I can't even imagine what it was like seeing him when he first started, but you told me a great story how he got Robin Hood Men in Tights with Mel Brooks.
Well, he came into the club from New York, and was there 2 weeks, I think, and I got a call from Mel Brooks, dropping names.
Pick that up.
He says, Bud, I just lost Eddie Griffin. I had him. Boy, you didn't know how lucky he was. I had him. I had him in.
Oh, I didn't have a new pair of white Air Force Ones every day of filming.
The film still taping.
Yeah. Wow.
So Eddie got a deal with HBO, so he couldn't do the movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He says, I need somebody, you know, that ilk.
And by that he means black.
Well, no, more than just black.
Yeah.
You know,
no, black, fine.
Wise
exactly.
Ass.
Wise ass. Yeah, of course.
And I said, Mel, I got Mr. Brooks, I got just the guy for you. Mm-hmm. He just arrived 2 weeks ago.
Wow. Now, was that because you thought he was perfect? Or it was
he was perfect for it. Mm-hmm. You know, Eddie, I can see Eddie, and sure. I see Dave. Yeah. And, you know, it's just what he wanted. It was, he was good. Yeah, terrible movie, but...
Right. Yeah, so...
Well, I'm still waiting for my call, Mr. Brooks.
Yeah, right? Yeah, seriously.
You don't need a Bud Friedman type?
Christ. When I told a couple comics, I'm just coming back from the Kansas City Improv, and a couple of comics said, you have to ask Bud, why a monocle?
Oh, why a monocle? That's a good question.
Bud, give a little tilt on the mic, just up a little bit.
Okay.
Or down to your face. There you go.
I started the club when I was 30, mm-hmm. and my eyesight was perfect. Mm-hmm. And as years progressed, I found myself okaying waitress check. Bud, would you okay this check? You know, and I didn't know what was... I couldn't see it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I was like the sheriff in the old western town. I didn't want to tell anyone I was going blind.
Sure.
Right? And I didn't want to wear glasses because I usually dress like this in a T-shirt sure. or mm-hmm. a shirt with no place to put my glasses. So I came up with the idea of a monocle, which would be very effective and very affected.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it worked, you know, so I've had it for...
And let me say this. When you're talking to a man who has a monocle, you feel a need to be a little more, to use that word, sophisticated around him. You know, you don't exactly walk up to a guy with a monocle and go, "What's up, motherfucker?" Like, you don't do that.
It's an accessory that exudes confidence and some sort of, you know...
I like that pretty much all the club owners and founders in Los Angeles, whether it be Jamie Masada, Mitzi Shore, yourself, you were all...
We'd like to do a face-off. I'd love to fight these fuckers.
So, wait.
Bring them on.
The celebrity death match that they would have.
Oh,
you know,
that'd be the best.
This Friday, Bud Friedman, Mitzi Shore, in a showdown of the ages. Inside a 15-foot-high steel cage.
My money's on you, Bud.
Yeah.
I would hope so. Yeah. I may be older. No, I'm not older than she is. Maybe.
But what I was saying is you're all such individual personalities, and any comic that's met any of you for more than... an hour or two, pretty much everyone has a Jamie Masada impression, a Mitzi Shore impression, a Bud Friedman impression, because you guys are such dynamic personalities. And it just shows that you have to be, in order to deal with comedians, in order to run a comedy club, you have to have that personality.
Well, Mike Lacy, who's the nicest guy in the world, has no personality. And so there goes the theory there. Yeah. I don't know.
What, you worked and saw Robin Williams, yeah? He came in a lot, didn't he?
Oh, yes. Robin came out to L.A. and
when he got Mork and Mindy, right?
No.
No, before that, okay.
78. He was unknown, completely unknown. Mm-hmm. And I put him on, and he was brilliant. But nobody... Why are you putting him on? People would say to me, he's got no act. I said, he's got something. You know?
Got something, yeah.
And
now, what had you seen prior that made you go on putting him up when people said, don't do it?
I saw what he could do.
Right.
You know, they couldn't see that. I don't know. But he said to me... I'm thinking of going back to New York. I still own the New York Club. That was before I was struck by that dread California disease community property and lost the New York Club to my ex-wife. But I still owned it. And mm-hmm. all the comics were moving out here, as I said earlier, because of costs and moving out here. And all. So Robin says, I'm thinking of moving back to New York to finish my education at Juilliard, get my degree. I said, mm-hmm. very good idea, Robin. I figured... I'll have a great act in New York for at least a year.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Yeah, so
great idea. Good. Yes,
transferring
you do it.
Your
Definitely
talent.
Do it.
Yeah.
He didn't listen to me. And look what happened to him. Poor kid.
Poor kid.
Whatever happened
He'll
to
catch
him.
He'll catch it.
I'll say.
He played a woman in some movie. Right?
Yeah.
Doubtfire or something.
It must be going terrible.
See?
Yeah.
See what, I mean?
See what he had to do?
See, that's why I'm not going in the dress. I'm not doing that. I don't want to end up like that poor sap, Robin Williams.
That's what happens.
One of the greatest, one of the most. The most insane moments of my career personally was I got off stage one time in San Francisco, and Robin was in the audience in Mill Valley where he lives. I never met Robin before, obviously an icon of comedy, and he's backstage, and he just walks up to me and goes, "Oh my God, Mr. Williams, you're like Prozac with a head." I'm just like, I can die now.
Oh, look at you.
Hey. Prozac with that head. And then he swallowed you.
Yeah. He does love his pills.
Not anymore.
Yeah, he's very, very clean now. But it's just, I mean, And like my surreal moment there was later that night, it was Robin Williams talking with Dana Carvey, talking with Mort Saul in a green room.
Oh.
And I'm there with my opener, Jeff Keith, and we both want to say stuff, but we're like, don't talk.
Yeah, just listen.
Just let this happen. And I can't imagine how many moments you've witnessed like that, where you have a prior talking to Rodney, talking to Robin, talking to whoever.
One of my greatest accomplishments, our first franchise was San Diego in 1985.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who franchises, a guy named Mark Anderson, who was a comedian, whose family was in the oil business, and through his father, Mark Anderson's father, he knew Jonathan Winters, and I knew Robin.
Right.
And I went to Robin, and I said, this is what I've never said before or since. Listen, hey, Robin, Jonathan Winters is coming to our opening in San Diego, and he'd love to have you there. And Mark Anderson went to Jonathan and said, hey, Jonathan, Robin Williams is coming to the opening, and he'd love to have you there.
Whoa.
And we got him on stage for the first time together doing stand-up.
Wow.
When
and
was this?
1985.
I think Jesus. I've seen that picture. I think there's a picture
with
of
a candle.
That. Yes,
right,
doing
right,
that.
Yeah.
And if for any idiotic reason you're not familiar with Jonathan Winters, Jonathan Winters is the founder.
You shouldn't be listening to this program.
Yeah, there you go.
Thank you. What do they do on stage together?
They just improvise.
Well, they're the two masters of improv. Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite comedy clips of all time is I think it might be the Steve Allen show. I'm not sure. It's an old late night show, and the host just hands Jonathan Winters a stick, and he says, "Watch what he can do with the stick."
Oh.
And Jonathan goes for 10 minutes just like doing different improvs with the stick, and he wasn't told anything. He didn't prep. He wasn't said he was going to get a stick. He just starts going, and it's genius shit. And Robin always looked up to Jonathan and thought that he was the master, which he was. And so the fact that you got them both on stage at San Diego Improv. And was that moment ever duplicated? Did they ever perform with each other again?
Oh, I think they have. Oh, yeah, they did. Yes,
but
see, and then our equivalent is seeing Dave Attell bring Brad up on stage and ask him questions about being a dwarf. Like that's not what we have. Yeah, which is also just as good.
No, are you kidding me? Yeah. No way. But you know, it's up
he
there.
He says no way. He has a nerve to.
Yeah,
say that's not a true story.
Yeah, yeah, of
like
course
we didn't think.
Yeah,
it was incomparable.
Yeah,
that's how big my ego is, bud.
Boy, oh boy,
that's how big I feel. You know what? These guys might think I'm as good as Robin Williams and Jonathan Winters. Let me take them down a notch.
Thank you. That's
let
nice.
Let me take them down a notch.
And those people who thought that should not be listening to this program either.
Now, what about Eddie Murphy? Did he ever pop into the...
Eddie Murphy was barred at the New York Improv for cursing by my ex-wife after she was running.
No kidding.
Club.
Really?
Which, well, needless to say, it's no longer there.
Yeah, but, that's why. That's I'm pretty sure that's why you broke up with her.
But Eddie popped in a few times. I'm not really a fan of Eddie. As a comedic actor, I think he's
brilliant.
Unparalleled.
Yep.
Brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
But as a stand-up, you know, he would say fuck like we were doing the Army. For no reason. And he had the nerve to say once that Richard Pryor gave him the right to say these words on stage because Richard Pryor did.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard Pryor always had a reason. Always had a reason for using the word. Not using it as an adjective or a noun or whatever.
Sure.
Adverb. And that's the big difference between Richard Pryor and Eddie Murphy.
Sure. What do you think that... Now, yeah, obviously, everyone wants Eddie to come back. And do you think there's, you know, and there's, you know, 20 years, I think, of just stuff that, you know, material they could talk about. But, I mean, what do you think there's something that's keeping him other than just maybe the fear of getting back up? Do you think it's true that if you take enough time, a break away from stand-up, that you can get rusty and really?
Oh, well, I'm sure you get rusty. But, you know, somebody like Eddie, you know, would have no problem getting back in.
Yeah.
No, he's smooth. He's a professional.
Yeah.
No problem with that.
You mentioned the name Alain Boozler earlier, and you had a bunch of different female comedians, obviously, throughout your years at the Improv, and Elaine's one of the founders of not founders of female comedy, but
Elaine was the first comedian to do non self deprecating humor, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
sure.
In other words, I always depict Elaine as unisex comic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's feminine.
Sure.
She's lovely, But her humor could be said by a man or a woman.
Right.
Because mm-hmm. it's not, oh, I'm so fat or I'm so short.
I think right. Ellen's whatever. The same way, don't you agree?
Ellen?
DeGeneres, maybe? Her observational
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean. Yeah, absolutely. But again, Elaine was the first.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, there was Joan Rivers and it was Toadie Fields, and they all did fat jokes, ugly jokes,
sure.
husband jokes, and
right.
quite a difference.
And yeah, and that's those are the female comics that I love the most personally. Are the ones that, like you said, you can give their material to a man and it wouldn't change. Doesn't matter. It's just, they're funny is funny, and it translates well. So I mean, now did you have? Because I know Mitzi had the belly room, which was supposed to be like just for female comedians. Did you ever feel a need to do anything special for female comics, or did you say fuck it, they're just like everybody else?
Yeah, I you know, everyone says oh they have it so tough. Well, in my mind they have an advantage.
Yeah.
Particularly, you know, going back to Elaine's days, because you wanted a woman on the stage if she mm-hmm. was good. Mm-hmm. You know, so I would rather if I had a choice between a male and a female, mm-hmm. and they were equal, I would pick the female because she's rarer. I once, do you remember Shirley Hemphill?
Yes.
She was a very, she was obese, acerbic black.
Oh, yeah.
An actress. She was on a series. Mm-hmm. And she and Johnny Witherspoon, Johnny and I were great friends at the time. For some reason, we're no longer friends. But anyway, they were coming across the street to the club from the Mustache Cafe. And Shirley was strictly a Comedy Store performer.
Okay.
And Johnny, I guess, did both. And Shirley says, how many brothers you got working here? And I said, what? How many brothers you got working here? You heard me. I said, I have no fucking idea. What do you mean? You haven't counted? I said, no, I haven't counted. Mm-hmm. And Johnny says, listen, Shirley, if he says he hasn't, he means it. Right. You know, I trust Bud. And I said, yeah, it's not like I have a special room for brothers or women.
and that's one thing that I think if you look at the three clubs in L.A., Comedy Store, Laugh Factory, improv to me is you guys kind of – the improv sort of gives comics the freedom to do whatever it is they want to do, and they don't try to categorize comics and like, okay, tonight is black night and tonight is Asian night. Well, you have a couple, but yeah. You tend to shy away from the themes, and you'll put you'll put an alternative comic followed by a piano guy followed by me followed by Adam followed by like it just you just say hey funny's funny throw everyone up there and let's see what you got.
Can you follow him, Adam?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there was a time when I couldn't. Well, it depends. If he does the dance, nobody can follow. Nobody can follow that. That Bill Burr even said that at the they were doing the April Foolishness show at the Gibson Amphitheater.
Yeah. Who said that?
Bill Burr had to follow Brad, and he was working out a bit about how I saw him work out the bit. That's why Bill was so great at the Comedy Store the night before about how Hitler didn't get enough credit and everybody, and it was about how like
I
Stalin.
I love the premise already.
It was that Hitler had more kills, but Stalin was like, Stalin didn't get enough credit. Hitler had the it factor.
Oh, wow.
He had the mustache and yelling, and he goes, Stalin killed way more people than Hitler. He goes, it was like comparing, you know, Thriller to Hootie and the Blowfish, like, you know, and he's working this out, and he just followed Brad, and 6,000 people were kind of off and on board, and then he just pauses and goes, you know what, you guys just fucking went nuts watching a midget fucking breakdance. You can't get behind my Hitler bit for 2 minutes. He goes, let me work this out, you know.
What was the show? I think?
April Foolishness. There's a radio station out here, K-Rock, and they do a comedy show every year. Oh. It's at the Gibson. And, yeah, last year it was Ari Shaffir, myself, Doug Benson, Bill Burr, and Jay Moore. And, and they do it every year. It's a fun night. And that's when Bill actually came off stage and walked up to me. And I haven't talked to Bill in maybe at that point like a year and a half. Yeah. And he's my favorite comic. So yeah. I'm like, all right, I got to get to talk to Bill. And he walks up to me and goes, why the fuck didn't you close the show? You should fucking close the show. And he walks up like, what did I do?
Nice to see you too.
Yeah, I pissed him off. Yeah. Jesus Christ. Ah. But it's just one of those nights. And it's funny to me because Kevin and Bean, who are the DJs that put on the show, they always advertise that as like you'll never see a night of comedy like this ever. And LA comics are sitting there going, well, or you can go to the improv.
Yeah.
pretty much every night, and who knows who's popping in, and who knows who's showing up.
Oh, totally. And that's a great, I mean, you know, there's nights, I mean, that I followed Chris Rock at the Improv, or now, you know, now Dane and Louis. I mean, it's what was like the equivalent, and we'll wrap this up in a few minutes. Like for guys like us, like to follow like Chris or Louie on a night, like were there
like Jimmy Fallon, an unknown Jimmy Fallon following Jerry Seinfeld.
Right.
You know, there you go.
And that's so. Isn't that to me is like really one of the great things that there's, you know, to have a club like that and those types of opportunities that obviously people coming in want to see all heavy hitters, but I mean there's something really great about seeing people they don't know and just feel like they're discovering.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But so, was there ever a night when you saw? Like somebody like a found following something that just couldn't follow it or was
I'm sure many times I try to block those memories out. But
who are the guys that were just so unbelievably undeniably that would slaughter that it was like doesn't matter who's going up next.
It's the guys we talked about. Yeah, you know, Rodney was the most one of the most devastating because
really?
He was so brilliant.
Yeah, he did a lot of crowd work too. Yeah,
yeah. A little bit. Yeah, not too much. No.
It's just you create in that club. I mean,
I'd like to see Rodney, by the way, follow Brad's lap dance.
He
like,
could.
That would be
absolutely.
If there was anything we could get him back for.
Fuck yeah! I just love the fact that at the Improv, I'll go to the Improv just to hang out, even if I don't have a set, and that's sort of an environment you create there. And whether it be at the original New York Club or at the Hollywood Club now. It's a place where comics just go. If you're not doing anything that night, you go to the Improv. If you go up, great. If not, you know you're always going to see friends. You're going to be surrounded by talented individuals. And
you have a bar and dining room to hang out in.
Sure.
That helps.
Well, we do now.
Yeah.
It certainly does help. And if you were to have your comedy Mount Rushmore, absolutely Bud Friedman's head goes on it, sir. So... Congratulations to you.
Nicely put, Brian.
Yeah.
It was a great compliment.
You could open with that.
You could open that instead of like, if you don't know who this guy is.
If you don't know who this asshole is over here.
I went from an unknown to Mount Rushmore. Wow.
In only 45 minutes.
I must have had a good podcast. That was very good. Okay.
Yeah, Brad. Yeah.
Well, it is, and every comic truly owes you a debt of gratitude for what you've done for comics and what you've done for comedy as a whole.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Huge
thank
honor for
thank
having you on
it
too, bud.
My pleasure.
Yeah. What's the Epic special? I want
Epic
you to plug
Heads
it one
December
more time.
December 6th, mm-hmm. and it'll be repeated about 400 times, and then we're going on to Showtime. I mean, Comedy Central.
Great.
Okay.
And that'll be shown 40 times actually. and it's a great.
And it's show. And it's I mean for a synopsis of it, it's going to be I mean just not only the history of the club and
the history of stand up modern stand up comedy really
and insight from people who came up
right.
in,
yeah.
I as a comic, I can't wait for that. And if you're a comedy fan, it's gonna. I can only imagine how good this is going to be. But it has truly been an honor to have you here, sir.
Thank you, Brad.
And,
thank you, Adam.
Thank you, Brad. And now, in typical Brad Williams closing the set fashion, Brad will now give Bud a lap dance on the podcast. And you just get the audio of it, which is just as good. And if you can't see, Bud, close his eyes. Looked like we just told him Christmas was over.
Oh.
I have never seen a more sad look.
Two boys sad about Christmas being over. That's a very poor analogy.
Yeah, yeah. I guess, all right, well, Rosh Hashanah has been postponed.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Hanukkah has been shortened.
Oh, okay.
There you go. Well,
by the way, the Improv never raises its prices on New Year's Eve on Rosh Hashanah.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
That's a joke, you see. Rosh Hashanah, New Year's Eve, raising the prices.
Oh, shit. I'm thinking it's taken seriously.
We are
well,
done
Brett,
with this.
You got me.
Right, are we all through here?
Well, no,
I lost all respect. All respect for you guys. And I'm having David move out.
David, your roommate.
Man.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, see, Brad shouldn't have, you know, you were right to just be staring blankly because, you know, you're not Jewish. For me to not pick up on the Rosh Hashanah bits, it happens.
Well, I qualified Rosh Hashanah New Year's Eve. I tried to explain to the goy, but, you know, as we say in French, the Gunnish help. Not going to help.
Do you know what that means, Brad?
I have no idea.
That's not going to help.
Okay. Perfect. On behalf of Adam Ray, Bud Friedman, I'm Brad Williams.
Thanks,
this has been the About Last Night show. Please try to remember our names in the morning.
That's how we close it. Thanks.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger. I've been friends with her for 10 years. One of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.